you on speaker and see how that works. Give me two free hands.
Okay.
Okay, you're on speaker now. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Oh, great. That's going to be great.
Now, I wanted to ask you, Mr. William B. Hutchison, if it's okay if I tape your interview today.
Yes, it is. You may tape it.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I worked up a list of questions, some things that I thought I would ask you if I need to, but it would be most important if you tell me stories that you remember best about your experience in the war during World War II. And if that includes stories that are outside of the Aleutians, that's okay too. And I do have your memoirs that you put together in front of me, and I might ask you questions about those as well.
All right.
So, I just wanted to start out and ask you some questions about how you got involved in the military in the first place. Can you tell me where you were living and whether you were drafted or enlisted or...
I was working in the FBI at Washington, D.C. I went there when I was 17 years old, just out of high school. And I always had an interest in aviation. My father used to take me to see airplanes take off and land. And when I was in Washington, D.C., I enrolled in George Washington University. And they had a civilian pilot training program, which I took. And I learned how to fly a little Piper Cub. Then I went to the Navy thinking that would give me a real good chance of becoming a naval pilot. And it did. And I went into the Navy. I worked for the FBI, and J. Edgar Hoover was a terrible person and refused to let me go, and so I just packed up and left one day.
Wow. So how come he wouldn't let you go?
Because he thought what I was doing at the FBI was more important. I don't know whether you know what a terrible person he was or not, but...
I do remember some of the stories.
Well, they're all sadly enough true.
So, where were you when, do you remember when Hitler invaded Poland in 39?
Indeed I do.
And so how old were you then? A teenager?
Teenager, yes. And I was, at my graduation about that very thing. I spoke about the need to get organized to fight Hitler.
And then do you remember where you were and what you thought when you heard the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. I was driving up in Northern Virginia with my girlfriend, and it was there Sunday afternoon, and I just thought the world... I had a hard time going back to school thinking how foolish it was for me to be in school. But I did go back and finish my course.
But then at some point you decided to join the Navy?
Indeed, I did. I'll tell you, the Navy has always appealed to me. More people in Iowa join the Navy than in percentage-wise than any other state. I don't really know that or not. But that's so. And there was a $500 reward for when I joined, and I thought I could use that too.
That was quite a bit of money then, right?
It was a lot of money.
So what unit were you attached to when you joined the Navy?
Say again.
What squadron or what unit were you attached to when you joined the Navy?
I was a cadet. I was an aviation cadet.
And where did you get your start then? Were you in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I was.
And then what kind of training did they give you after that?
Well, I started, I had already gone through civilian pilot training through George Washington University. And then when I enlisted in the Navy, I became a cadet and started the procedure, the long training procedure out of the Navy. Go to pre-flight school and then to flight school and then to special and then to Pensacola and eventually become an ensign.
Do you remember how long that training took?
I would say the better part of a year.
Okay. And so you were trained as a Navy pilot?
Yes, I was.
And what kind of airplanes did you fly?
Well, I flew, I chose to fly multi-engined bombers when I was still a cadet. We got a choice what we were going to fly. So I chose multi-engine land-based bombers. And then later on, development happened. You know, a VJ outfit in the Navy is a preferred squadron in which you must be able to fly any aircraft that the Navy has. I got selected to go through that training, and I was told by the man who recruited me to fly with the VJ outfit that he had sent, because of the nature of the assignment, had sent a letter of commendation to me from him. And I'm right in the process now of finding out if he ever did that. I'm writing to the Navy Records Department. I have one letter of commendation from the Air Force. In flying Navy Reserve, I was in a Navy Reserve program in Lincoln, Nebraska, and the Air Force base was right across the field from us, and they had a terrible accident, and I got there. And was instrumental in saving a man's life.
Oh. It's probably not often that another branch of the service would give a letter of commendation to another fellow, so you must have been very important in that incident.
Yeah, I have the thing in my hand, the letter of commendation. So I'd like to see if there's another one there, and I have just written to the Bureau of Records to see if I can get a copy of my folder. So there you are.
That's great that you got that. That's something I bet you were held very dearly through your life. So, after you went through your training, then where did you go?
I went to multi-engine training at Lake City, Florida. I was an ensign then, and then I was assigned to a squadron in the West Coast, and I went there, and then. As I told you, there was an opportunity for me to fly a VJ squadron, which was sort of the elitist thing that you could do, because you had to fly every kind of plane made. And I flew for them. I flew dive bombers for them, but I flew other aircraft too.
Yeah, I was thinking you must have been pretty valuable to them because most people just got trained in maybe one or two different airplanes, but so you must have been a pretty natural good pilot.
Well, I guess I was. It seemed I saw a picture of a plane that I flew, and I think I could crawl in that plane and fly it today.
Do you think because of your skills, did they carefully choose where they were going to send you, or do you still think it might have been a random choice of where you ended up in the war?
I think it was a random choice. I think people had to go where they had to go, and that was part of the whole thing. A lot of people didn't get to go where they wanted to go, but I certainly did. I cherish my experience with the Navy, and
Did they ask you where you wanted to go?
No, I don't think they did. You just knew where you were going to go. If you chose multi-engine, you were going to go probably to the Pacific, which is what happened to me.
Okay, so where did you go after your training?
Well, I went to Attu, and then came home from Attu because of a weakness in the plane we were flying, and it was then that I flew with a VJ outfit. But then I went back to the Pacific for 2 years.
When did you arrive in Attu? Do you remember about the time frame?
I can't remember. I think I talked to getting off a plane and crawling into a tent-like place to stay. I heard my name read on the radio by Tokyo Rose. She had my name and my number and my hometown down, as she did everybody else's in the whole squadron. That was really a shocker.
That was right after you got to Attu?
It was the day I arrived in Attu.
Wow.
And she knew what day it was.
Did you ever find out how she knew?
Never had a clue. Never anyone ever gave me a clue. It was well known that she would do that, and one person told me it was a thing that the Navy kept in touch with newspapers, that all of us came from areas where a newspaper was involved, and that she had a list of those names which were not terribly essential to the war effort, but were certainly frightening to shake up to hear your name being read by a voice 1,000 miles away. It really upset you.
I bet it did, yeah. Well, so you must have gotten to Attu after the Japanese had been expelled.
Yes, that is true.
And so first of all, how did you get to Attu? Did you ferry an airplane up?
Yes, I did. Through an airplane up from Whidbey Island to Attu, up to Dutch Harbor, and then from Dutch Harbor to Attu.
What kind of airplane was it?
It was called a Harpoon, which is a PV-2, I believe. PV-2, yes.
Right. So you said you had problems with that airplane. Do you remember what the nature of those problems were?
Yes. The wingtip was manufactured by a furnace company, and they were not. And they would come off pulling out of a steep dive. The tip would come off, and it didn't affect the flying. The plane still flew, but it was a little lopsided, and that was enough to frighten everybody, and then we were called back to the States. Have our planes redone.
So you had to take all that whole fleet of PV-2s back to the States?
That's right.
Did you continue to fly them after they were fixed then?
Yes, we did.
Okay. And what kind of missions did you fly?
They were I told you, we had a business of keeping a lighthouse broken down. That was at Cape Lapaca. And it was what the Japanese fishing fleet depended on to avoid hitting Russia. And so we would knock that lighthouse down. It would take 2 11-inch rockets placed strategically at the base of the lighthouse, and it would bring the whole lighthouse down. 2 days later, it would be back up again.
Really? So they were pretty quick at getting it functional again.
They were terribly quick.
How many missions were you able to fly over there?
I think I flew 21.
That's a lot of missions. Do you over what time period, do you know?
2.5 years.
Given the weather there, that's a pretty good number of missions, isn't it?
It is indeed. But they were not all hazardous. Many of them were surveillance, or we would attack the fishing fleet, which fed the main Japanese mainland, and it was a pretty easy prey. They were most of the fishing boats were unarmed, and they were easy to put down.
But you probably never knew what you were going to get when you flew missions over there. You must have gotten jumped sometimes by their fighters.
I think I sent you a picture of Oscar attacking me from behind.
You know, you said you were going to send a picture, but I didn't see one in the envelope.
There was one in the envelope, but I have another one if you want it. The main fighter at the time, of course, was Zero. But Oscar was their second best fighter aircraft, and that's what was assigned to the Northern Kure Isles to protect them. And we would occasionally make a raid on the bases, naval bases, which were where we lost. Each time we did it, we lost a crew, a plane, or two.
Really? Every time you attacked the naval base, one of them went down?
Yep.
Wow. And so I guess you were pretty lucky because you made it back.
That's right. And, you know, I found a poem about a year ago that tells exactly how I felt at the time. And that was that, you know, flying up in the beautiful sky in a powerful piece of airplane was pretty easy and pretty wonderful. And when things went bad, they went bad at sea, and you went down and no one had to look at you being shot. I had a cousin who was a doctor in the Navy, and my mother would write and tell me how terrible he had it, and I thought, my God, I don't know why my mother says that. Doctors stay in steel operating rooms and big ships, but this cousin was assigned to a Marine landing squadron and hit all of the bad places in the Pacific. He wrote a letter to his father, which was never sent because of censorship, but it was told about how he slept overnight with two of his buddies both dead beside him. I never had anything like that. I'd see a plane go down in the freezing ocean. That would be the worst I ever had. It was all over. It was a matter of seconds.
But that must have been a pretty bad memory for you.
Yes, it was, in a way, yeah.
Because you knew those guys in the airplane, right?
Yep. And the thing was, getting there was probably worse than what happened when you got there. you're flying over water at 36 degrees, in which you last about 15 seconds. And there are young kids that were in my crew, younger than I. And one of them said he would never, ever get in a plane again.
How old were you at the time when you were flying those missions?
Well, I would be 19, 20, 21.
Oh, so you were the old man on the crew, huh?
I was the old man.
Well, that's a pretty, you must have been really good at that young age to be flying a multi-engine airplane already, being in charge of it.
Well, it was a wonderful thing to learn to fly and to have such a wonderful aircraft. The aircraft I had was a Harpoon. We flew with the Air Force, who did not even have heated compartments in their plane. We had heated pressurized compartments in our plane. We had a stove that had hot meals for 8 people in it. We had a plane that would fly 800 miles on a single engine. And I always felt that we were superior to the Air Force because of the equipment we had.
While yours might have been a little bit a better of an airplane and more comfortable, it was still the very limits of its range, those missions you were flying, right?
Well, yes, but when we got the Harpoon, we added 400 miles, and it made it, if you missed getting back to Attu, you could go someplace else. You had enough gas to go someplace else.
Oh. That must have been a kind of a comfortable security you had there with a little extra fuel.
It was indeed. It was indeed. And the speed of the aircraft had not been slowed down at all. It was a remarkable aircraft. My grandson, traveling in England about a year, maybe 2 years ago, found a book about the airplane, the Harpoon, and it reminded me of, and you might be interested to know that one of the people quoted in that book was a member of our squadron that I think I've mentioned his name to you, and I can't think of it at the moment.
Is it Elmer Lurker?
No, Elmer Lurker. How did you know Elmer Lurker?
Well, you mentioned his name the other day, so I wrote it down.
Oh, you did? Well, you shouldn't have.
Oh, okay.
Because Elmer Lurker dropped a wing tank right smack on the deck of a huge Japanese fishing trawler.
What happened there? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, you selected what you wanted to do on the yoke. That's the steering wheel of a aircraft. You have a button that releases 5 different things. Charges guns, puts down flaps, puts down wheels, drops wing tanks, drops bombs, and you select what you want to do. Then you press the button after you've selected what you want to do. Elmer somehow selected drop wing tanks instead of drop bombs. So anyway, Elmer died about two months ago, so I guess it wouldn't be so bad.
Was he embarrassed about his mistake?
Yes, because I had a picture, a beautiful picture of him, of the bomb right straight in front of me. And I had to swerve up, pull up, and dump my bombs in the ocean. And so he had made a bad mistake, and I, many years later, I offered to give him a copy of the picture, and he said, "I don't want it." So,
did you give him the business when you got back?
Yes, I did. But then it could have happened to anybody. That is often another time in my life. When I was flying SBDs, a dive bomber, a young man from New Guinea, who had been in a Navy squadron with an 80, mind you, an 80% attrition.
Wow.
Came back and who was looking for a temporary place to fly, and he chose my VJ outfit. And I knew he was drinking too much, and I was an ensign in charge of a naval air station. The air station was Clatsop County Airport, Clatsop County Naval Air Station. And there were only six of us there. And he was one of the six, and he selected in taking off, instead of raising his wheels, he raised his dive flaps, and he went straight in and was killed, of course.
Oh. Where was that station you're talking about?
That was a little naval air station at the mouth of the Columbia River.
Oh, okay, I know where you mean then. Okay. Well, so where were you flying these SBDs?
Out of that little naval air station. I was servicing carriers that came. I was a boogeyman, and every other flight I was vectored out to intercept another person flying a boogie flight, in other words, a false attack on a carrier.
I see. So would you consider that a training?
Yes, it was training for radar and shipboard personnel.
So was this after you left Alaska? Then you went down to Clatsop?
Yeah, this was in the interval that I had when we found out that the wingtips of the harpoon were coming off and we had to take the planes back to be altered. There was an interim time that it took to put the wingtips, change them on the harpoon.
Okay, so then you flew the SBD while that was happening?
That's right. You got it.
And then did you go back to Attu?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so you spent 2.5 years total on Attu?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a long time.
Well, yeah, but then I subtract from that 2.5 years 6 months.
That's still a long time in many people's books.
Yeah.
Were you on Attu when the war ended?
Yes, I was. I was indeed. And I was, because of Russia's position as being a non-belligerent as far as Japan was considered, we had to stop flying immediately after the bomb was dropped. That was the end of our bombing activity.
So did they ship you off Attu pretty quick after that?
I stayed on for a while, flying SB-2Cs out of Amchitka.
Oh.
Because we were still doing submarine searches in the Pacific, even after the bomb was dropped.
So, did you say you flew SB-2Cs out of Amchitka?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, okay. So they thought there still might be sub activity.
That's right.
Okay.
I would fly 500 miles south of Amchitka. That was halfway to Wake Island, turn around and fly back. I never, ever saw anything outside of some little ships.
And how long did you end up doing that?
I was just trying to figure out how long I did it while you were posing another question. I would say, I know I had a good time doing it. I fell in with an Army rescue outfit, 12-cylinder, powerful surface anti-submarine, and they would take me out and put me in a basket and rescue me on tape, on film. And they had marvelous food on board that little anti-submarine thing. And so I was enjoying myself, as I always did.
So you were a Navy guy, but you were working pretty closely with the Air Corps, Air Force guys.
Yes, and I was feeling that the Air Force there had done a good job defending the island, but a poor job carrying the war to the Japanese. Their planes were not equipped in any way to fly 800 or 1,680 miles. To do a little bit of damage. In the time when we had joint operations, it was not unusual for no Air Force plane to make it to the target. I hate to say that, but that's the truth.
Mm. Did the two branches of the service work pretty well together?
Yes, there was some evidence that they had accomplished something working together, yes. And there was none of that strife about nothing had stopped the Army Air Corps except the Navy. There was none of that. No. We understood that their planes were not our planes.
Mm-hmm. So I hear the Navy food was better than the Air Corps food. Is that true?
That for a change, my friend and I would go over and eat in the Army mess. And we ended up getting our Navy clothing stolen because we would hang it on a rack outside the mess tent. But as I recall, the food was not very good at the Army base. So my friend and I, in retaliation, stole a command car and parked it up on Gary's Point, which is a part of Attu, and parked it, and it sank in the tundra almost. And then, well, we went back a number of months later to the Army mess again, and there were our coats hanging on the rack. Of course, we took them. But we never took the Dodge command car back. It just stayed sunk in the tundra.
So I guess you got the better end of that deal.
Yes, we'll learn.
So how about sleeping quarters? Were those very good on Attu?
Well, by then we had Quonset. And they were adequate.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have urinals, but we were high enough in the... we could just go to the back door.
How was it being your age, you know, late teens, early 20s, to be living for a couple of years on an island like that?
Well, it was... Every day was an excitement of some kind. If it was just... On our day off, we were going to walk down. We heard that the Army had brought a load of ice cream in. And we were going to go down and see if we got caught in a winter snow squall and got lost and had to wait huddled up until the wind stopped. We could see where in the hell we were.
Oh, jeez.
And then we got down there and found out that the Army had taken all the ice cream. And we were half a day late.
So it sounds like the weather was pretty bad there.
It was totally bad. It was one day we heard a plane grinding away in the fog, and pretty soon I was outside and I heard the motors stop, and I knew that they had hit the mountain. And it must have a wonderful they hit the mountain of 3,000 feet above where we were, everybody on the plane survived. They all walked, stepped out of the plane and fell down the mountainside in one huge snowdrift. They were having a great time. And I was one of the happiest moments on that, too.
Yeah, that's an incredible story to have the whole crew survive a plane crash.
And it was a USO for entertainment that was in the plane.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was a USO.
Do you remember who was on the plane?
I don't remember. In fact, nobody that I knew at the time.
Uh-huh. So did you see a lot of aircraft? You said when you went on the bombing runs over Paramushiro and the Kuril Islands that you saw aircraft go down. Did you also see a lot of crashes on Attu or in the Aleutians?
I'm afraid so.
And were those usually weather-related?
Yes, they were. Yeah. It was and I always think my success in avoiding a crash had little to do with my skill as a pilot, but more to do with how much wind and how much fog there was. I just had it good and easy.
Did you get to choose whether the weather was good enough for you to fly on a given day, or was that decision made at a higher level?
It was made at a very high level when they said. And you didn't always agree. In fact, a lot of times you... And sometimes I thought, well, I don't see what's wrong with today. Better than yesterday. We flew yesterday. So it was arbitrary, I'm sure, and I'm sure the man who made it didn't want to make it.
So you didn't always feel very comfortable with the flights that you were sent on.
That's exactly right, and sometimes you felt that they were not necessary. We had a flight one time with a bunch of retired cruisers from World War I. It took them forever to get to the target, and when they finally did get there, one man was washed overboard, and it was, the whole thing was a bad, bad idea. It was a B-24 Army and the Navy cruisers.
Did you have feelings at times like you thought you might not make it through the end of the war because of the kind of flying that you were doing? And
that thought crossed my mind, but I was never afraid of the engine failing. I just knew that was a great aircraft, and I never thought about. And I was a good. I could fly very well in fog. Radar, we had Loran, which was a brand new device that told us where we were exactly. Loran later became the forefather of the automatic systems for knowing where you are now.
So you thought the Loran system worked pretty well for you during the war?
It was time consuming. It took a little bit, it took about 20 minutes to get a good fix. But you can always get a good fix.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when the Loran became automatic, that was the beginning of the end of navigation. I went through naval training when I had to learn celestial navigation. And that caused more people washing out of the Navy program than anything else.
How well would that work in the Aleutians?
Loran was everything, and Loran was not there, of course, when I first went there, but it got established, and it was I don't know whether you know anything about Loran or not, but
so that with that navigation equipment, the PV-2 was probably really a two-pilot operation.
Indeed it was.
Yeah.
Actually, three,
okay.
Pilot, co-pilot, and then somebody to do the navigation.
So,
and we divided it pretty much three ways.
So who was? Did you have a consistent crew on your airplane, or did you fly with different guys?
Same crew. Marvelous. Three young men were just absolutely. The radio man was one of the smartest kids I ever met in my life. He knew more about the mechanics than the mechanic did. He knew more about the guns than the gunnery guy did. And he knew he was an excellent radio person.
Do you remember his name?
I do indeed.
What was his name?
George Sproul, Sproul.
Oh, okay. He was always your radio man?
Yes, always.
Mm. And do you remember the other guys you flew with?
Yes, Jack Holmes, Holmes, and Marvin Davis.
Okay. And were those to the other two, which guys were your co-pilots or helped you pilots and navigators?
There was a Roger Patterson. And Marvin Davis is the young man who said, "I'll never get in an airplane again after the bomb was dropped." He said, "No, I don't ever have to get in an airplane again."
Do you know if he ever did?
I don't. He was a person who wanted to forget as much as possible. So I have a wonderful letter from him telling me exactly why he doesn't keep up correspondence. So other two did. Jack Holmes was the mechanic, and he went. We didn't go back to war. He joined the Air Force and became an Air Force pilot. And, Marvin Davis, I don't know what he just avoided thinking about his experience. So, we had a downdraft. And he was asleep in the tail of the plane, and he went up into the ceiling of the plane and was knocked unconscious. And really, I thought he was dead.
Oh.
But that was one of his experiences that didn't sit well with him.
No wonder he was didn't want to fly anymore.
That's right.
Did you keep in touch with any of your other crew members over the years?
Yes, I did. George Sproul.
Is he still alive?
No, he's been gone for 10 years.
Oh,
so young, marvelous man.
Did you keep flying after the war?
Yes, I did for 14 years. I stayed in the Navy Reserve.
But you didn't, you never bought yourself an airplane, a private airplane?
No, I never did. I joined a group one time, and the group bought a plane, and I flew it so seldom that I quit that. But, and I was routinely flying marvelous Navy planes.
Were there any that weren't so good? Or had bad features?
Oh yes, I was a pretty bright cadet at Pensacola, and if you got a certain grade on navigation, you got not Saturday afternoon off, but Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon. And I wanted to go down and learn to fly a seagull, which was a beautiful. engine and an air-cooled inline engine, which is a mistake to begin with. It didn't have enough power to get off the ground unless the wind were at least 40 miles an hour. I was allowed to go down and crank up this Seagull and try to get it off, and I never succeeded. I'd make a wake by flying with the wind and wiggling it back and forth and stirring up the water, spinning around and trying to go up the wake I'd made and thinking I could get it off the ground, but I never could. And that was a plane that was built by the Curtis Company, which was operated mostly by retired admirals. And I always thought that was a terrible waste of money. How a plane that couldn't take off.
Yeah, so it was only kind of a trainer, or they let you do it for fun? They didn't really use it in service?
They couldn't use it in service. It was just there. And they kept making them and kept shipping them around. The OS-2U was the float plane that was used most often. It was an old design, and it was very good at what it did. It had enough power to get off a choppy sea and enough stability to allow to operate in the open ocean. OS-2U was a good plane, but the Seagull looked so beautiful. Just absolutely beautiful. And couldn't fly worth a damn.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen a Seagull.
Well, it's a beautiful plane. It had a narrow little nacelle. It had an inline air-cooled engine. If you know anything about engines, you'd know that that is a hard thing to do. If they're in line, the rear cylinders aren't going to be cooled as much as the front one.
Yeah, so the ones in the back might run pretty hot.
That's right. You've got it. Huh. What's your background?
Well, I am a pilot. I got my license when I was in my 20s, and we still own a couple airplanes now. We have a Cessna 180 on floats and a little Citabria two-seater on wheels.
Oh, that is marvelous. The 180 is a wonderful plane.
Yeah, we like that airplane quite well.
Yeah. I have a cousin whose son flew from Los Angeles to New York and from New York back to Los Angeles when he was 12 years old.
Wow.
He's now in charge of the Chinese Air Force.
Really?
Yep. Yep.
How did he get to be in charge of the Chinese Air Force?
Because that's what he did in this country. He was never, I don't know how strong his connection was with the Bureau of Aeronautics, but he always had that kind of a job where he was testing and trying and setting up things in the aviation world. His name is Tim Chisholm.
Chisholm?
Tim Chisholm. TymCzymiCizum.
Wow.
Of Polish descent.
No kidding.
So, and he can't come home as long as he has that job. So his family hasn't seen him for several years.
Oh.
Well, they've gone to China to see him. His father was a big wheel in aviation.
Sounds like your whole family's quite talented that way.
Well, it sort of turned out like that. I was born on an Iowa farm, learned how to repair a two-cylinder John Deere tractor. Make it run.
Well, that was probably a very good skill to have.
It was then, yes.
Yeah. Can you think of any other flights or experiences that you had during the war that were particularly memorable, or people that you remember?
Yeah, I think I've told you about some of them. My friend and I, the Navy had marvelous clothing, and we had green hooded coats with a fleece lining that could be taken in or out, and that was just absolutely right for Alaska. Air Force guys were going around in skimpy little leather jackets, colder than hell. So as I told you, my friend Hank Green, who flew with our skipper, he and I went to eat at the Navy mess, or our Army mess. And while we were there, we took our coats off and hung them on the rack and went back. And of course, they'd been stolen. So we stole a Jeep from them. A Dodge Command car. Gary's Park, which, if you know, the island of Attu is where Commodore Gary's ruled the roost. And so, anyway, we went back a couple months later to the Army mess, and there were our coats hanging on a rack. Evidently, the people that stole them were wearing them into the restaurant. Well, my friend and I stole our coats back, but we didn't get to tell them where the Jeep was.
Did you ever find out who stole them?
No. I should have done a little detective work, because it was a real blow to us to lose our beautiful coats.
I bet, yeah. And I heard you guys had better equipment than the air guys. The Air Corps.
Yeah, I always felt overdressed, too comfortable when I was around Army flyers. They had skimpy little leather jackets that they were stood around shivering in. And I always thought, oh dear, what a terrible thing to have happen. But there was another incident. The Japanese on Attu had a fair electrical generating capacity and lines to different places. And my friend and I discovered the generator and thought, well, the generator, we ought to go into the generating business and see that we had electricity. So we cranked up the Japanese generator, and I could hear people screaming and hollering. There were Americans working on the lines. And while we were cranking up the generator, it was electrocuting them.
Oh, no.
No one was killed, but we should have known better.
Did the Army and Navy get along very well on Attu?
There wasn't a lot of contact. There was not a lot of contact. Only if you made an effort to have a contact, did you? And my friend Hank Green had a cousin who was in the Air Force up there, and we made an effort to see him whenever we could. So,
when you were on Attu, were both the Army and Navy airfields, were they paved?
They had iron. There is a picture in one of your calendars of them laying down. There was an iron, a perforated iron, they all fit together.
Oh, the Marston mat?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what all the runways were.
The one on Amchitka as well?
Yes, indeed. And it was a mile long.
On Attu?
On Attu, it was probably 7,500. It was less than a mile, I know.
Oh, but are you saying the Amchitka runway was a mile long?
Indeed it was. It was,
oh.
It was a possibility of landing B-29s there.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that long.
Yeah. And I think the island has since become radioactive, hasn't it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, they did so much testing on it.
Yeah.
And all the evidence of World War II's probably pretty well been obliterated.
They tried different things. They dug a trench along the mile-long air strip, and they would pour gasoline into that mile-long strip and set fire to it. And it worked to the point that they could land in a black haze instead of just plain fog, but at least you had an idea of where the runway was.
Oh, okay, so that was the way of finding the runway.
That's the way of finding the runway.
Oh.
I never saw it operated. When I flew out of there in an SB-2C, it was non-operating. In fact, when I landed, I had to have help getting back to the station. Amchik is a totally flat island. And I don't know how it did, but if I called, a Jeep would come out and get me and lead me in. But that was another time that I'll tell you a story about that. In SB-2C, there were two wooden runways for your feet. And then there was a canvas spread between those two runways. And beneath that was a bomb bay. And the canvas was soon gone. And my second time out of Amchik flying SB-2C, I had taken a pencil to make sure that I had a pencil for the... are you familiar with an E-6B?
You mean in the cockpit?
Yeah.
No, not really.
Well, it's just a big E-6B that you pull out and do your navigation.
Okay.
On it. So anyway, I took off and I leaned over too far and damned if my pencil didn't come out of my pocket and fall clear down in the bomb bay. And there was no other pencil to do navigation with. So I decided that I would lean over real quickly and bend down and crawl down there and get that pencil. I could see it. But every time I would get ready to reach down to get my, I would throw the plane off its setup nose position, and so then I would quick get back in my seat and pull the nose up a little bit with a control. Try it again, and this time we would go just the opposite. It would start slowing down. Oh, shoot, I can't have that. I took my shoe and my stocking off, and by slipping forward in my seat, I could reach the pencil with my toe and get a hold of it and brought it up and was in navigation business.
So did that canvas, the canvas between your legs, is that how you were able to get your foot down there?
No, the canvas had been long worn out and gone. And it was no longer, you know, a lot of things in a plane that aren't used sort of deteriorate.
Yeah.
They get left behind or something happens to them, and that's what happened.
Oh, that was lucky that you were able to get that pencil back.
And because I had 500 miles straight south, 500 miles, 180, 500 miles, 360. And there was a big chance of missing my Amchik Island, but it was a wonderful experience. And I made a real good contact with the Army Rescue Unit. They fed me steaks as long as they could take pictures of them hauling me out of this. And, you know, I was basically, I was just they had a wire basket they were bringing up, and a kid threw a bucket of water on me. I screamed.
So hey, how often did that go on?
Well, that was just once, and they had this is how lax they were. They had whiskey in gallon jugs aboard that sub chaser that the Army had. Now, the Army had an air sea rescue unit, wasn't that strange? And they were more interested in going to sea and chasing white sea otters, of which I got to see a lot.
Really?
They were very rare animals, and that time there was for killing one, it was a $10,000 fine if you got caught with one.
I had never heard of a white sea otter.
Well, they looked like white snakes as they swam in the ocean. Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, I imagine, yeah.
I wonder if they're all gone.
Well, you know, you guys were out there a lot more, so you probably saw more than what we're able to now because they do surveys and things like that, but, you know, maybe they just don't spend the time out there that you all did.
I suppose that that's it. Anyway, that was my connection with the Army, and they were wonderful guys. Had the kid that threw, I'm going to have you, I said, you son of a bitch, I'm going to have you court-martialed. I was so mad, and of course I cooled down, because he was a brash young kid who was probably doing what somebody told him to do. But there were laughs.
So do you remember it as being kind of a good time in your life or not?
Now that I'm sitting at almost 90 years of age, I think it's maybe the best part of my life.
Did you make a lot of friends there?
Yes, indeed. They're all dead now.
That must be kind of sad.
It is indeed to be a survivor. And then I made friends with the children of some of my squadron mates. And now they're dying off, so that happened to me just last week.
Wow.
Hank Green's son, who was a dear friend of mine, lived in Salt Lake City. He was 63 years of age and he died.
Oh, that's a shame. That's too young.
Much too young, yeah. And he was a 30-year veteran of the Utah Air National Guard.
Oh.
They did refueling for all over the world.
Were there other guys that you served with that maybe weren't on in your crew, but that were important to you or that you made friends with?
Yeah, there were some. They're all dead. I might tell you about a man that I made acquaintances with in the reserve. And we'd celebrated Navy Day in South Dakota. The governor had been an ex-Marine fighter pilot. And so he asked for us to come up from Lincoln, Nebraska and do a flyover. And they have a crowd of people there and they would have a loud public address system established and people had come to see the event, could hear both sides of the conversation. And so as I was pulling out a man, a force striper, that's a captain, hauled my aircraft and said he was going to go with us. And he went with us. And we were flying at no one's to go below 100 feet as we flew down the runway because there were people seating in bleachers on both sides of the runway. And so anyway, we were going down there and this Marine pilot who had been an ace, I can't remember his name, children. We're not going to fly down there at 50 feet. If we do, we'll drop a shit bag on you. And that went out all over the whole plan. And somebody in the tower said, well, the Navy plane that made that land stretch mission identify themselves. And I said, like hell. And I, this little guy was, later I had another contact with him later on, he goofed up again. But, that time it was not serious.
Well, you might have been a young guy, but you weren't stupid.
Yeah, well, I oftentimes felt I was having too good a time for this to be true. There's a wonderful poem I've learned since. It says the people who flew aircraft didn't have the dirty part of war to face. Their losses were at sea or at land, were picked up by proper people, and their bodies were disposed of, and we didn't have to suffer any loss of any kind, which in a way was true. So that's that. I can think of a lot of other things. As soon as you hang up, I'll think of a lot of things.
Yeah, well, I've had you talking for more than an hour, so you're probably getting, your voice is probably getting worn out.
Well, are we through, do you think, or should we go on, or what?
No, you know, I think between your memoirs that you wrote and your interview today, I think we have captured quite a bit of it. I really appreciate you allowing me to talk to you and spending the time with you today.
Well, thank you. Just don't mention Elmer Lurker's name.
Okay, I'll make sure he's not identified. We don't want to embarrass anybody.
That's right, although he passed away 2 months ago. Mm. Well, I suppose we don't even have to be careful about him.
Well, if you don't want his name in there, I'll make sure it doesn't show up.
I think that would be nice. His wife is still alive.
Okay.
And I'm sure he's... are you in touch with Sweeney?
Oh, yeah, Will Sweeney. Mm-hmm.
I have a marvelous picture of him as a teenager.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, I've never seen that. You know, he's pretty, doesn't like to give up too much. He'll share everything he knows about all of the other crews, but he doesn't really say much about himself.
Yeah, but I can't remember who he flew with either. I'm looking at the pictures.
I think I have the list. Do you want me to dig it out?
Pardon?
I think I have the list of crews.
Oh, yeah.
Will's been really good about giving me information about the Navy crews that he knows about.
Well, you know, did I tell you that my grandson bought a book in London in a bookshop about the Harpoon? And in that book, there are 4 pages of Will Sweeney.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you remember the name of the book?
Oh, I got it right beside me. Harpoon. Harpoon 2. Just a minute. Polly?
Yeah?
Right beside my chair is a blue book of the Harpoon. Could you bring that in to me? Down on the floor, I think. There's a lot of good information in it.
Okay. Yeah, maybe I can get a copy.
You know, do you ever use the book finder thing on the...
Oh, yeah. You know, I see Will's crew was Edwin Ogren, Donald Causer, James Hoyle, Edward Bauman, and Joe Barrier.
Yep.
I don't think
It's a blue book with a picture of my aircraft on it, right beside my chair, to the right.
Yeah, Will's been very nice to write out lists of all the crew rosters that he knows about, and that's been very helpful because I can refer to it and place people that way.
Well, he alone was responsible for our retirement get-togethers, and I'm going to be gone for just a second. I'll be back.
Okay. That's okay. I was trying to look for it myself while you were.
I have it here. Osprey Combat Aircraft 3-4. The name of the book is PV Ventura Harpoon Units of World War II. And
that sounds like a good book.
It's got marvelous pictures in it. And it has Will Sweeney. Will Sweeney's name about a dozen times, which I'm sure he didn't mind.
I found it.
Oh, you did?
Yep. I'm going to get a copy of it.
Well, there are a lot of wonderful pictures here. The Empire Express, participating crews. Let's see. Snow was falling on Attu on 25 March 44 when five of the unit's PV-4s prepared to take off for a strike on Japanese installations in the northern Kuril Islands. Will R. Sweeney reunion flying with Boris Georgiev. Yeah, I knew he flew with Georgiev.
Oh, he did. Okay.
And that's on page 26. Boris Sweeney radio man flying with Georgiev recalls the mission. It was a 5 aeroplane operation against Kukubanzaki on Paramashiro. Paramashiro was the hardest place of all. They always managed to get one plane, either shoot it up. So the incident I wrote to you about, which stands out in my mind, is flying back with a plane that was flying on a single engine, 814 miles on a single engine, a heavy plane.
Was it another PV-2?
Yes, it was. And they made it, and I stayed right beside them, and I don't know what the hell for, because if they had gone, there was nothing I could do except possibly drop another
a raft or something?
Yeah. And that would have been unlikely.
And then
they made it back, and then they made it back, but had to make a go-around, if you can imagine this. He made his approach and made it too high, I suppose, because he was on a single engine, but he was going to overshoot the runway. So he had to pour the coal on a one-engine plane that had just flown 800 miles, pour the coal on and stress the engine to the point that it could have been fatal, and make it go around and land successfully. And we cheered. That was a happy time for everybody.
Do you remember what crew was on that airplane?
Oh, sure. I told you in the letter. My memory is such that I know it, but I can't. He was a particularly nice man. He was a Chevrolet dealer from southern Missouri.
Was that Lieutenant Garnett?
Garnett. Thank you.
Okay. Now, if their airplane had gone down, and even if you got them a raft, what are the chances that they could have rescued them? They probably didn't really have good capabilities that far out, did they?
0-0-0.
So all you could do was say that you saw what happened to them.
That you could tell their survivors.
Oh. Did you talk to Garnett after he landed, after he had to do the go-around?
Oh, heavens, yes.
What was he thinking? I bet he was just darn glad to be on the ground.
That's exactly right. Particularly where he felt upset by his screwing up his landing, his single engine landing, and having to make a go-around, which requires a lot of power.
I'll bet, yeah, and a lot of skill probably too, right?
Yep.
Now, do you remember anything about the story about Bomber 31, the one that they found recently in Russia?
Well, I have seen the movie.
Mm-hmm. But do you remember any of that happening when you were on ATU?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't remember. It was just another plane lost to Petropavlovsk. There was always the possibility that we would end up in Petropavlovsk. And that was not a good thing to have happen. So,
did they have any way of notifying you guys about missions, about who was lost or who was missing or anything like that?
I think eventually the Russian, between Russians and the Navy.
Or even out on your base, did you have any idea what happened on a day-to-day basis to other crews?
Yes, because if a crew is going to be interned, they usually talk to... We rarely flew a single plane mission. We would talk to the guys, and they would say, well, we're going to be interned. We have, Garnett had an oil cooler on for the starboard engines shot clear off the plane. And he would, in fact, he even talked to our base about it. Oh. Talked to the skipper about it. And they had taken a vote. And they voted to not be interned, but to try to fly back. And that is really a remarkable feat, to stress an engine like that. And usually, I stressed an engine one time. If you squeeze the two throttles together, you could go by the stops. And that put more pressure on the engine. And it was known that if you did it more than 15 seconds, you very well could have an explosion.
Oh, boy.
So I did that one time. They tell me I only ran 10 seconds, but I didn't want to get near 15 seconds, and in 10 seconds we'd pulled away from Oscar, who wanted to shoot us down. Anyway, you have everything you want on the book?
I do, yeah. I found it already, so I'm going to get myself a copy. Thanks for giving me that information.
Beautiful picture of a harpoon. The only trouble is, it's not a harpoon that they pictured. I can tell because the tail empennage is different for a harpoon than for a PV2. So,
is that the cover photo you mean?
Yeah, the cover photo is not a harpoon. The harpoon has the two vertical stabilizers on the back. Are clear at the end, and they do not extend through the stabilizer. How can you tell, Paige?
Pardon me? How can I tell what?
How can you tell what page? Okay, the harpoon, picture of the harpoon are on page 46. And you'll see that the tail empennage is very different.
It won't show me that much. It only gives me a few pictures to look at.
Really?
They want me to buy the book.
Of course, of course. I think my grandson told me it was $34.
It looks like this one I can get a copy for $18 now.
Really? Well, I think that's about what my grandson paid in pounds.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. You know, it all depends on when you get it and how rare it is, all those things.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's a marvel. I think it's a marvelous book. It tells pretty much the truth about the plane.
Well, good. I'll get myself a copy. Well, thank you very much for talking with me today. I bet you want to go get a drink and rest your voice a little bit.
I have a cup of coffee. My wife just brought it in.
It's hard to talk for a long time like that.
Well, it's been a lot of fun for me talking to you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to transcribe your interview, and I'll send it back for you to take a look at. And then if you want me to make copies of the audio and transcription for your family and friends, I'll be happy to do that.
I'll tell you what. I have one of my surviving friends, Bob Phillips. I'd like to have you send a copy to him.
Okay.
Phillips, Dr. Robert and Dorothy.
Robert and Dorothy?
Yes, 52 Newcastle Road, Rochester, New York. 14610.
Okay.
And the telephone number, I don't really need that, or you don't need that. But he is a survivor, and was a particularly good friend of mine. And we've seen a lot of each other in the ensuing years.
Okay. Well, if you think of others, too, before I make the copies, I'll check with you and see how many you want and where you would like them mailed to.
Oh, how nice. That would be marvelous.
Because I imagine others would be interested in hearing your stories, too.
Well, I have 15 grandchildren. I have 13. 15 granddaughters and 2 grandsons.
Wow.
So that sounds like an unfair adjustment, isn't it? One of my granddaughters thinks that I won the war.
That's okay. If she believes that, that's fine.
But I got to tell you a little story. She is in high school, accepted a chance to visit Japan and stay with a family that she became acquainted with very nicely. And then to turn things around, the Japanese girls came here. And my granddaughter, who lived just 3 blocks away, came over and said, "Gramps, there's no reason to talk about the war." And I said, "That would be the last thing in the world I would talk about, because my wife is going to have a Thanksgiving dinner so they could experience that." And so the day came that the girls, 2 girls came from Japan to stay with my granddaughter Rachel at home, came in the house, and one of the girls said, "How are you? Have you ever been to Japan?" And I said, "Oh, yes, many times." So I looked up at my granddaughter, and she looked absolutely stricken. Like, sure with an axe. And it turned out that was the only English this girl knew. "Have you ever been to Japan?" She had no other knowledge or any English at all. So my granddaughter kept saying, "Grandpa, what were you going to say next?" I said, "I would have thought of something that wouldn't have embarrassed you." But that was a little joke we had. It's been nice talking to you.
You too. I'm sorry it took so long to get back to you, but I'm sure glad we had a chance to talk today.
Well, I'm going to write to Joseph Hutchison and tell him I am the reason he did not get Book of the Month Club. He must have gotten some, because I remember there were some that I didn't get.
Well, I think he'd be thrilled to hear from you.
Well, I will write a little note to him right today. Thank you so much for everything.
Thank you, too. You take care of yourself.
All right, I shall.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.